So if you cannot keep up with Slavoj Žižek, you know, just fall asleep. Slavoj is one of the founding professors of this program, has been here all the years except last year, when he became something, I don't know, the new heart or something, improved heart. So is improving your heart also improving your thinking? We will see. We just agreed that he will now be the Jacques Lacan professor here at EGS in order to bring more traffic to our school. Please welcome.
Let me thank Wolfgang, and at the same time, in advance, my apologies, as usually, I tend to be too long, but to bribe Wolfgang for his patience. At the very end, there is a big celebration of this EGS Institute. So if you interrupt me, you cut the branch which you are sitting. Okay, so let me begin, because I really have anything to say. As you maybe know, or at least if you don't know it, you sense it, every legal order, or even every order of explicit social normativity, has to rely on a complex network of informal rules which tell us how are we to relate to the explicit rules, how are we to apply them, to what extent are we to take them literally, how and then are we allowed, solicited even, to disregard them, to disregard them, and so on. To know these unwritten rules of a society is to know the meta-rules of how to apply its explicit rules, when to use them or not to use them, when to violate them, when not to use a choice which is offered. For example, often we are obliged to do something, but we have to pretend that we are doing it as a free choice. Recall the polite offer meant to be refused. It is a habit to refuse such an offer. Anyone who accepts it commits a vulgar blunder. The same goes for many political situations in which a choice is given on condition that you make the right choice. You are solemnly reminded that you can say no, but you are expected to reject this offer and enthusiastically say yes. With many sexual prohibitions, the situation is the opposite one. The explicit no effectively functions as an implicit injunction. Do it, but in a discreet way. Let me give you a political example to make this logic clear. The problem during the chaotic post-Soviet years of the Boris Yeltsin rule in Russia, I think, could be located at this level. Although the legal rules were known, largely the same as under Soviet Union, what disintegrated, so my friends told me, was the complex network of implicit unwritten rules which sustained the social edifice. For example, if in the good old Soviet Union you wanted to get a better hospital treatment, a new apartment, if you have a complaint against authorities, if you were summoned to a court, and so on and so on, if you want your child to be accepted to a top school, if a factory manager needed raw materials not delivered on time by the state contractor. Everyone knew what you really had to do, whom to address, whom to bribe, and so on and so on. After the collapse of the Soviet power, one of the most frustrating aspects of the daily existence of ordinary people was that these unwritten rules largely got blurred. People simply did not know what to do, how to react, how are you to relate to explicit legal regulations. Somebody told you this is prohibited. Yes, but what did it mean? Is it really prohibited? Somebody told you, go and do that. Were you really allowed to do that? And so on and so on. And I think that one of the functions of the organized crime was precisely to provide a kind of ersatz, legality, and clear order. I had the misfortune, because he was patron of arts, intellectual meetings, to speak with a middle-level businessman who told me, I have a mafia protection, and I need it. It's not only that they extort profit for me, but for example, if a contractor doesn't deliver me things, or if somebody doesn't pay me, it's ridiculous even to bother with police. You call your mafia protectors, and they deal with eventually with the one who protects the other guy, and so on. And I claim that destabilization in the last years under the Putin reign mostly amounts precisely to some kind of newly established transparency of these unwritten rules. It's not that now there is really more legality. It's simply that people are getting accustomed to new implicit rules. You again at least know whom to bribe, what you really can do, what you cannot do, and so on and so on. Now, far from introducing a kind of a total oppression where you can't even do anything, every resistance is in advance integrated, I think that on the contrary, the awareness of this complex network of unwritten, often obscene rules which sustain the explicit normativity is crucial today in two aspects. First, it accounts, I think, for maybe the crucial level at which homophobia, sexism, racism, and so on operate today. It's not so much at the level of explicit rules, but precisely at the level of these implicit, obscene rules. Point two, sometimes you can violate these rules in a very productive way. I think that the awareness of this gap even opens up a whole new space of, okay, resistance. I remember, if I may boast a little bit, from my own youth in ex-Yugoslavia, we had, under communists, elections. They were not as bad as in Soviet Union, but the result was absolutely known in advance. It wasn't, as in Soviet Union, 99.9%, but 85 usually, the communists won. So I was a member of a committee of a small, half-dissident, half-tolerated journal, and we thought on the election night what to do to introduce some kind of a scandal and so on. One idea was the suicidal move. Let's simply protest these elections were not free. Then we got it, nothing would have happened. Probably the issue of our journal would have been immediately confiscated, and on the top of it, people would laugh at us, haha, big news, as if we didn't know it. We did something much more effective. We said, okay, you pretend elections are free. Let's just treat them as free. So we simply, on the election evening, publish a special issue of our journal with big front page title. Latest news, it looks that communists have a chance to remain in power, and so on, you know. Just the reaction was unbelievable. They were so mad at us. In the Central Committee, an old apparatchik called us and shouted at us, boys, no provocations like this. Then we just played idiots. We said, but what's wrong? You claim the election are free? We just treated them. And I really sympathize with this apparatchik, because when we asked him, tell us what did we do wrong, he wasn't able to say, don't fuck with me. You know very well. What did we do wrong? So you can do things. The status of these sub-rules or meta-rules telling us how to deal with explicit rules is that, of course, of a shibboleth. The publicly non-proclaimed sign of distinction known only to those who are in. A sign whose very existence is invisible to those who are outside. So I think this is why the first rule of an egalitarian emancipatory politics should be no shibboleth, please. It is against this background that one should reread Jean-Paul Sartre's deservedly famous description, you know, from Lettre à Léon, of a waiter in a café who, with exaggerated theatricality, performs the clichéd gestures of a waiter and thus plays at being a waiter in a café. Here is a short quote from Sartre. His movement is quick and forward, a little too precise, a little too rapid. He comes toward the patrons with a step a little too quick. He bends forward a little too eagerly. His voice, his eyes express an interest a little too solicitous for the order of the customer. Finally, there he returns, trying to imitate in his walk the inflexible stiffness of some kind of automaton. End of quote. Of course, as a Lacanian, I immediately recognize how Sartre's underlying ontological thesis, the waiter in the café cannot be immediately a café waiter, in the sense that this table is a table, how this thesis points towards Lacan's classic definition of a madman who is not only a beggar who thinks he is a king, but also a king who is a king, or a waiter who really thinks that he is a waiter. But nonetheless, there is a much more complexity in Sartre's description.